One of the common occurrences for people who come to practice a spiritual discipline is that it's often based on a mystical or metaphysical experience that goes away. And the loss of that spectacular knowing, that vastness of experience, that huge unfolding of what feels like the universe, the sense of seeing so deeply into the core of existence, and then to think you get it, or you know it, that this is unforgettable, and then it's forgotten. Then it goes away. And probably the first question that comes up is, what did I do wrong? Why can't I hold on to this ineffable, exquisite sense of truth and reality that at one moment totally filled the universe and took over my existence? Usually what happens after that is that it initiates the search for spiritual understanding. What happened to me? Has this happened to anyone before? And how do I get it back? Where do I look? That usually necessitates reading lots of books. Starts out with whichever one you pick up. You know, I picked up the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu song of God. I don't know why I picked it up. Somebody gave it to me. And they said, read it. And I did. And the minute I read it, I said, I know everything it's saying. I just know all this, that this is true. What would have been a complete abstraction to me suddenly was not abstract. But what was abstract was my hold on this knowledge and wisdom. And then I started looking into Tibetan teaching, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Todol. And it was so clear to me that Tibetans knew what I was talking about. And then I read a book called Perennial Philosophy, in which Aldous Huxley just looks at every world religion and talks about how every world religion has at its source, at the core of its being, a mystical teaching. And finding that teaching, finding how do I get to that place? How do I get to the place that all the great teachers spoke about when I have just witnessed it and lost it? So for many people, it's a journey. For me, it was the journey to the East, you know, the hitchhiking. Well, first of all, I went to Greece and, you know, with a ton of books to read, and then I decided I needed experience, not books, and so I ended up getting rid of all the books and going to India and going from ashram to ashram to ashram, trying to find somebody who could establish all of this inside me and give me that experience again. And mostly what they gave me were rules about if I did this and this and this and this, perhaps then at that. So I remember going to ashrams where Shivananda Ashram had an obelisk with the things you could not do. And they were, you know, have sex, eat meat, dance, on and on. And I kept going, really? I didn't feel like that's the road that I wanted to go, but I started going to other ashrams and meeting all of these teachers, and they were all, in one degree or another, rather accomplished people. Many of them spoke about their religious awakenings and their experiences, and I just knew none of them were speaking to me. And I couldn't tell why they weren't speaking to me. What is it that they're talking about that is so alien to my sense of what this is all about? Why aren't they connecting? Why aren't they providing me with this re-entry into cosmic consciousness? And I gave up. You know, I finished my journey to the East and came back to America, and I remember breaking down and sobbing tears with my parents one night, and I couldn't explain it to them because they had no idea what this search was about. I mean, they knew I was in India, and they knew I was looking for something, and they knew that I had gone off on some cockamamie quest. But now I was in sobbing tears, and you know, they figured I needed a psychiatrist or something, which I knew was not going to provide what I was looking for. And then I went to New York, and as the story goes, I had these Tibetan carpets to sell, and from monks I was living with in Kathmandu, and I took them to Rudy's store. And Rudy asked where I got them, and I said in Kathmandu, and he asked what I was doing there. I said I'd gone to find a teacher, and he said, did you find one? I said, no. And he said, well, I can teach you everything you want to know. And that was not true. Even though he sat down and gave me the exercise that I've shared with everybody who's in this room, and I practiced it for 45 years, and even though that exercise was profoundly important in my life, even though it gave me what I would call a life, which turns out to be incredibly important, it did not, in and of itself, reawaken the spiritual dimension that I expected. I remember in a dream once, I was sitting with Rudy in a cab of a truck, and I said, if I don't get an experience soon, I'm going to go back to finding it somewhere else. And he said, really? And he said, here. He touched my forehead, and I exploded out of the truck in my dream, and I was in the core of the universe, and I came back and said, wow, wow. And then the dream was over, and I was back. It was just a dream. It was a dream. And I went, whoa, well. But it kept me studying for a long time. In the end, I just felt, it's not happening. It's not happening. And of course, you all know, I mean, I started looking into other meditation forms. I looked into Vipassana meditation. I did retreats with Eckhart Tolle and non-dualism. I came across the teachings of Isagadatta Maharaj and his book, I Am That. And these are all powerful, powerful teachers, and still nothing. Nothing. And then, one day, I said, I give up. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to do this practice. I'm not going to meditate. I'm not getting anywhere. I didn't get there. I didn't get to whatever that thing is I thought I needed to get back to. And I stopped. 2 weeks later, again, you've heard all this before, but I'm sitting in a lecture on non-dualism, and the lecture is over, and something had changed. And it wasn't that I had suddenly become that mystical, connected, vast, imaging, incredibly big experience of awareness. Something else happened, unexpected. There was no Bruce. Bruce just went boop. Something to do with having let go, having said, I give up. I can't do this. It's not getting me there. And the thing that came in that moment was the loss of the particular and the arrival of the totality. Everything. Suddenly, everything. But it wasn't everything in the mystical sense that it was full of colors and flashing lights and bigness and unspeakable truths. It was so much simpler than that. What arrived was this. This. And it was so funny because clearly this had been here the whole time. And the only thing that hadn't been here the whole time was me. Where was I? I was seeking that. I was always in pursuit of that. I was looking and struggling and trying and breathing. And I mean, 45 years of meditating every day to get there, trying to arrive at something that was in my mind, the place I was supposed to get to. And what happened in the awakening was there was no me trying to get anywhere. I was simply where I've always been. And where I've always been, minus Bruce, minus the particularization of Bruce, was everything I was talking about. Except it no longer had otherness about it. It no longer was something mystical and out there. It was mystical and right here. Right here. And that was really the most phenomenal part of it. Because I finally understood, if there's such a thing at that point as understanding, that I had never ever been separate from myself. Ever. And that the Bruce story, the Bruce character, the Bruce journey and drama was part of the totality. It had to be exactly as it was lived. It had to go up to the moment of saying, I give up. I had to go step by step by step and follow the path of stupidity and ignorance and looking and wanting it to be there and thinking it should be there and what is wrong with me and all of that stuff had to be there in order to come to the point where I finally said, can't do it. And then the revelation was so small, so tiny, it was actually in a way invisible. Because all I found was that this idea of Bruce wasn't real, or it didn't have ultimate substance, that it was something that came together for a reason. I wasn't clear on that reason, but I knew it needed to be there in order to lead me to this moment where I saw who I was. That was the journey. Once you see who you are, do you see fireworks going off and images of infinite time and space and colliding energies and galaxies? No, I mean, not really. It was so much more than that in a way, because there was nothing that I wasn't. Nothing that I wasn't, including all of you. And it was very clear to me that there's nothing that you're not. That what took place for me is not a Bruce Rubin event or a singular event for one person. It is the collective consciousness. Mostly, however, the collective consciousness is unconscious. It's lost in its own drama, in its own daily complications. And the problem with that is that those complications are very, very rooted in loss and grief and sorrow and struggle and attempt to get something that's not there, including enlightenment. And so you end up in a place of a kind of ongoing misery, which I've talked about a lot in this class today and recently. This pursuit of the thing that cannot be gotten. The thing that we called earlier today happiness. The idea that somehow you are trying to arrive at a place that is not here. That's there. And that's a simple mistake. But everyone is making it. Everyone is making it. All the time. You know, I will get there. If I keep working hard and doing my due diligence and the stuff I'm supposed to do and live properly and I'm a good person, I'll get there. Yes, you will. But when you get there, truly, you're just going to realize you've always been right there. The there you're going to get, you're sitting in. So the question that comes up is, what can I do to facilitate your going, oh, I get it. Oh. Oh. Huh. I know how your minds work because I have had a mind just like yours, and in a sense still do. The mind is still there, but it can't grasp the extinction of you. It can't grasp that. It's not an idea that makes sense. You're so fundamentally you. You're so fundamentally in your own mind, in your own thoughts all the time. Day and night, you're thinking about you. You're thinking about your issues, the thing you got to do next week, the stuff that didn't get done. It's going on all the time. That's why meditation tries to quiet that down. Just shh, quiet down. And then, sometimes in the quietude, you start to really feel the thing I'm talking about. But it's a thing that takes place in time and space and within you, and therefore, when you lose it, you think you can have to make your way back to it. And I guess the thing I most want to communicate is that you never really lose it. It comes and goes. It kind of comes and goes on its own schedule. And you can push it along by meditating. You can push along this experience of going deeper into your unconscious, or let's call it bringing consciousness into your unconscious, and begin to feel these amazing networks of awareness permeating your entire body and reaching out of your body into everywhere you are. There are people who will tell you, interestingly, that consciousness is that which you're conscious of. In other words, consciousness is not something you have that is aware of that. Consciousness is that itself. That is, your consciousness is the hardness, the sound, the feel, the subtlety, the presence of that is consciousness. It's not you're aware of that, which is awareness. Consciousness is the experience of the totality. It's the feeling and the touch and the sound, and the whole thing is your consciousness. So what's expanded consciousness? Well, first of all, there's refining your consciousness so that it can go deeply into places that it doesn't normally go in your daily life. One of those places would be the chakras. If you go into these places, and Nityananda was famous for saying, go into your heart, in your heart chakra, and roam. Roam. Not sit. Roam. Go into this space and then watch how big it gets. You can journey. It's like, whoa. You feel, if you really can take your attention inside, your awareness, you're now being conscious of a universe inside you that is present. It's very there. It's like here. It's subtle. It doesn't have the same exact tangibility, but it's there. And you can feel yourself moving inward and watching this thing give way, the waters part. And as they do, you start to discover these areas of sensation that are exquisitely beautiful. And you are aware of them because they're familiar. The first time you look at your child, or the first time you look at your mother, or the first time you realize how beautiful a flower is, that feeling is kind of happening from in here. It's like, oh, it feels so beautiful. When you fall in love, that's coming from in here. So if you know how to make that journey in, you become conscious of an entire universe and space within yourself. And that space keeps giving way to deeper and deeper and deeper emanations of itself. And you start to become deeply conscious. Deeply. And the muscle that's reaching deeply into that space, Rudy used to call it a muscle, can then reach deeply into life. So you can start actually looking at people and feeling your way into them, because they're really not constructed any differently than you are. So I can look at people and I can see, in the same way I can look into the personal self, or the deeper inner self, I see the self as well. When I have looked inside and seen obstruction and darkness and blindness and denseness, and I start to move into that and penetrate it and penetrate it and penetrate it, I start to see the journey. And then when I look at you, I see exactly the same thing. I see the same density, the same obscuration, the same lack of development, if you will. And all I have to do is go in deeper. And I feel you as though you're me. I feel what your mind is doing. I can hear your mind going, oh my God, Bruce again. I can hear your mind going, oh, that was great. Oh, I should have written that down. I hear it. I hear it all going on in your head. I watch your insides. I'm not judging it, any of it, because it's like looking at myself. But I hear what you're going through. I feel what you're going through. I feel your heart straining to open when all it wants to do is relax and open. So I try to tickle it sometime from the back part to kind of give it an opportunity to get distracted from your effort. Because your effort is often the very thing that obstructs the thing. It's really a kind of profound relaxation and a deep reaching into yourself, deep, deep reaching that allows you to begin to know you as an internal being and as a reflection of everything that's outside you. And it's a remarkable condition because life becomes unbelievably rich. The mystical experience that you had when you started this journey may not have paid off with flashing lights and thunderbolts. It pays off with something much more remarkable, which is, and I say it over and over, this. This, on the superficial level, is just stuff. Just stuff. You know? It's oh God, another day. It's kind of what it is. But when you start to dig deep through meditation, through intellectual thought, through feeling, the day becomes something much more remarkable. And there's awareness in you of its time-based creation, the idea of a 14 billion year process creating this moment, which I love to think of as having been created solely for you. 14 billion years of creation so you could be here, so that we could be here, so that we could know each other. That's pretty powerful. And yet you start to go to a place where even time and space start to dissolve. You kind of do it every night, guys, when you dream. You live in a place where time and space are completely amorphous. Things change, they move from one thing to another. It's another world, really. And yet it's your world, and it's very powerful. And you begin to learn to navigate time and space. In this world, the dream life is different. Most of you don't know how to do wakened dreaming. Waking dreaming, or there's another word for it. Lucid, thank you. Lucid dreaming is a way of navigating that world. I've met people and even took a course once in lucid dreaming. It was fascinating to me. Lucid dreaming, most of the people who were there wanted to be God. They wanted to control the universe of dreams. And that's really what they were looking for. And also because they could be powerful in that world much more readily and easily than they could be in this world. So I kind of decided that's not a world I wanted to play in, because we all know the dreamscape. And we all know how quick and easy it morphs into one thing after another. But so does this. And last week, I talked about this life that we're in as slow motion chaos. This life that we're in is here for us basically to be able to see, touch, smell, feel, and in some way know reality. Because real reality is not easy to perceive. It doesn't cohere. So what we have here is a short-term coherence called life. And that coherence is an opportunity for each of us to look at life and know what it is on some level. Nothing we can walk home with or bank on particularly, but we can know certain things about it. One, love feels great. Being kind to other people and good feels better than being shitty and miserable and hurting people. That if you break certain commandments, life has consequences. If you obey them, life has consequences. You learn all of that stuff embodied in this universe that we're in right now. But it's very short term, and it evaporates like that, just like a dream. A lot of people will tell you this is just a dream. Even the oldest song that you learned as a kid, you know, row, row, row your boat. It's just a dream. So the mystical experience splashes you into the outer confines of that awareness, and then you come back into this bodied form and get lost in it. And then something reminds you, oh, there's that other biggerness, and then you're lost in here. And the lost in here is still there. That's the only thing I can tell you. It's still there. The only thing you need to do is either say, I accept that and live a good life and wait for it to return, or fight like mad to kind of make it come back, to come back. But when it comes back, I unfortunately can only tell you one thing. It doesn't come back as you or for you. It just comes back in spite of you. It comes back and there is no you. There's just this. That's how it comes back. And that revelation is a new universe of exploration and understanding, and it's an extraordinary space. But are you courageous enough and willing enough to go there? How much do you want it? Do you need it? I don't think you do. I don't think you need any of this. I'm not sure most of you really want this, you know, because if you do, you'll get it. And so, you know, you're standing over the abyss, you know, the way people describe it. I like you're standing over a warm pond. And do you jump in or not? Do you want to come in or not? You know, the abyss is terrifying. The pond is like, you know, come on in. It's really beautiful. It's worth it. It's wonderful. If you want this, it's yours. If you don't want it, don't be upset. Don't beat yourself up over the head. Don't think you're doing something wrong. You're not. You know, if this thing is the thing you want more than anything, trust me, it will come. Because really, it has never gone. And the deeper secret, of course, a lot of non-dualists say this, there never was a you in the first place. This is all a very temporary construct, and it's a false construct, and it disappears. So, in the end, you're all going to get awakened. In the end, you're all going to realize, oh, Bruce was right, or whoever else, there's a lot of people saying this stuff, was right. Do you need to find it out? The only reason I would say yes to that is what they promise you as a result of it, which is liberation. And what are you liberated from? Well, it's a really interesting thing. You're liberated from the burden of you. That's what you're liberated from. You are a burden to yourself in most cases. Maybe you don't know it, but most of you are probably pretty exhausted at this point with being you. And if you're not exhausted yet, great, then why do this? If you're walking around with you and are just having a great time, it's wonderful. The only thing is that you will be lifted off of you anyway at some point. So even if you're loving your life, you know, be prepared, because you will be extracted from it. And then what? Well, you'll work it out at the time when it comes. I mean, that's basically, it's like, who cares about any of this, really? You know, it was such a big deal to me to get somewhere and then to realize that I would never get there because there was nobody to get there. And then to arrive at where I've always been. And I go, okay. And I will tell you, I love the moment-to-moment arrival of what is. I love it. I'm amazed by it. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's difficult, challenging. But it's not a challenge to me. It's a challenge to itself. Life is a challenge to itself, you know? You don't think that You know, all the little creatures that are running around that are getting totally displaced by global warming aren't being challenged by the forces of life. Everything's being challenged by the forces of life, including us. It's very complicated. The world is enormously complex. And you can take it personally, but even if you don't take it personally, even if it's impersonal, which it really is, it's still an amazing thing to experience. This is what's happening. And to see it through a very narrow little prism of you just isn't going to give you much of a picture, and it's really ultimately not satisfying. So I question a lot why I come to Big Indian, why I sit here and give this talk, why I give it every week in San Rafael and go down to Los Angeles to say this over and over and over again. It's like a salesman who's kind of not selling his wares, who loves the selling process, but nobody's buying. And I don't know what to do with that. It's a very strange thing, because I know what I'm talking about is, it's a pretty good product. It's called existence, and you already own it. And the only problem is I'm trying to sell you on getting rid of the part of you that's lost in it and doesn't believe it. And that's a weird job, you know, to do that, and to fly across the country to do it, and, you know, to come here to this, you know, this place that, you know, with an outhouse and, you know, with all the problems that it presents. But it's a gathering space to share something that people like Buddha and other great teachers have told us is the road to awakening, enlightenment, liberation, freedom. And some people say joy and bliss, which I think, yeah, but also sadness and suffering. I mean, not suffering personal, but profound awareness of what this is. It's a big, big pool of vibrant energies, and ultimately dissipates into absolutely nothing. And the magic of that, the mystery of that, the wonder of that, that it emerges from nothing and becomes this. I don't know if you can see Nityananda above me. Oh, I don't know if that gets in there or not. That's my teacher, my teacher's teacher. You know, what is that? What is all that about? Why has my whole life been devoted to this? I think we're all on that road, guys. We're all devoted to that. And if it takes you 500 million lifetimes, or two more lifetimes, or this time, or tomorrow, it's kind of all ends up at the same place, an incredible awareness that you are what is. You are the totality. You are this. It's a great adventure. Mystical awareness that comes and goes is just part of the journey. It kind of wakes you up to what you're supposed to be doing. I get this feeling that in every lifetime there is a mystical occurrence for people. Some people take it seriously, some people do say, what was that? And other people decide that they're going to devote their life to seeing what it's about because it looks really important. Is it important? Well, I can't answer that. I just know there's nothing else. If you want to know what this is, I mean, you're never going to know what it is, but you're going to definitely, definitely be one with it. And you already are. Any questions?
I had some medical issues a while back, digestive kind of, and I'm not a big doctor, believer in medicine, did natural stuff. But one of the things I did was, through meditation practice, kind of learned how to go inside. And when I went inside, I found my body reacting in these incredible ways, and realized, I think, that this is really my natural state. And the only reason Mike is here is, well, Mike is here, but Mike exists when people interact with Mike. I take care of Mike's bills. When Mike has issues at work or something, you know, I come to the rescue. But Mike is something that people call me.
No,
and I don't know how everybody else relates to this, but it's just been my experience all my life.
And they all relate to a different Mike, by the way. Not to the one Mike.
Not to the one I think.
Yeah, right. But they're to their own version of the Mike.
Right.
And so there are millions of Mikes going on in the world, none of which you are even basically aware of.
Well, you get a little feedback.
Yeah, you get a little feedback, and you go, really?
Yeah.
That's what you think of? That's,
well,
that's
people won't really tell you what they think either.
Well, yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, the what you are, who you are, is deeply, deeply personal you. That is also a completely universal you. And when you start to come upon that, it is, like, the word is clarifying. And it's, and I don't, I think it's very important.
I think the realization of this natural state that I think I really am is incredibly, it's just amazing. It's I'm able to do this stuff with, and it's, I would say with consciousness, but I don't know if that's what it is, but somehow I'm able to go inside my own body and move things around.
And we all are. It's just,
yeah.
It's just,
oh,
doing it.
Yeah.
You know, we have a society that pushes up the other way. Doctors will take care of you. They'll give you a pill. They'll do this and that. Only when that stuff stops working or doesn't work do you start to say, oh my God, I've got to do this.
Right. And there must be something else moment.
Yeah.
Another one.
Well, I mean, I think that's the journey. You know, the journey is into taking over and taking charge of this existence that you have found yourself in and taking responsibility for it and surrendering deeply to the fact that you're not what everyone tells you you are. You are what you have discovered you to be. And that's, then you have to, you go with that. What
it's
is that?
It's very revealing, I mean, because it's not even, you know, as much as you think you know what you are, it keeps changing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it does. Because there's no, the constant, I won't go into it, but mostly it's an underlying content. The changeability of things, which is really mostly what we're aware of, you know, that's consciousness, is the changeability. That's something that we come to know, and we come to know it either in a very narrow way or a very broadly defined way, and that's up to you. You can be severely unconscious in life or wildly conscious and aware. That's your choice. Jill, you had a question?
Yeah, when you were saying you're a salesman and nobody's buying it, it kind of struck me as we must be buying it because we keep coming back.
Well, that's true.
But the other one is, it's interesting to me, you always say you're telling the same story, but while you were talking to Mike, the Mike I know and the one you know, I was thinking about how you watch a movie, like I'm a repeater. I'll read the same book forever. But each time you do it, you hear something different, and it puts it in a different place for you. So that's what you are. We're buying it, is what I want to say.
Well, at least you are.
I am.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, no, in a way, no. I think there's a kind of hunger for bring me truth. Bring me truth. You know, living in the unconscious illusion that is so unpleasant for most people is not a good ride. And yet I see most people living it, not only living it, but actually fighting to have it. And I would like to be able to just lift them out of that, but I can't, you know, because you have to do it. You, each one of you has to do it. And it's not that you can actually do it, because like I say, there's no you to do it. So there's a kind of you that just has to go, I surrender. I give up. I give up. Thy will be done.
This popped in my head, so I guess I'll ask. I used to have a business, and there was this person came in, and he brought something back, and it was a return, but he had to bring it back. Anyway, so I said, oh, it's a beautiful day. You know, it was a Saturday. And he goes, yeah, I'm going shopping. And I said, oh, well, after that, you can whatever. Oh, no. So it turns out he goes shopping every Saturday. And I asked him what he did with all his stuff. And he had no, it was like, I asked him, how could I get to the moon? He had no comp. And that one has always stumped me. Like, if I go back, it pops in my head. Like, what is that lack of awareness to the degree that you don't realize that you're shopping every Saturday for stuff you don't even need? He even said, oh, that's right, he said he gives it away. A lot of it he gives away.
Well, I mean, there really are. There are people who do that. I mean, a lot of people go shopping even not to buy, just to go to be stimulated, just to keep.
Well, Rudy said, in a simplistic way, so when you're buying something, you're getting energy.
Getting energy, yeah.
Getting energy, yeah. Getting.
Yeah, but.
And when you're selling, you're giving energy, basically. As a metaphor for his business.
Yeah, no, I think in terms of a person who works in that kind of a space where you're a seller, you know.
Yeah, the state of the person she's talking about was buying things because he wanted to get energy, you know, in that sense.
You know, it's like eating 6 gallons of ice cream to get energy. Ultimately, it has a consequence.
No question about it. Nobody needs the stuff.
Yeah. I think stuff is a really interesting phenomenon, and a lot of people, by getting new stuff, think they're participating in newness, but they're really burdening themselves with more stuff to get rid of. And the getting rid of stuff is at the core of what we're talking about. Getting rid of you and all the stuff that you think you are, all the stuff that you've been told you are, all the stuff you have, ultimately letting it go is the way you start to find out what's real and meaningful in your life. You know,
I've always wanted to work with people who are dying or near death experience. I think because that's when reality set into most people, that they have to let go. And they were shedding everything else that was totally unmeaningful from your life.
Yeah, I think that's the norm. When you die, you learn this stuff. The only difference is we're talking about trying to do this a little bit beforehand, because there's a value to that, or there could be a value to that. And you will discover, in fact, if there is a value by trying it. You know, and I will tell you from my own story, the value is that which has remained in my life as I've shed more and more stuff and people and experience and work, is that what remains is more powerfully perceived and appreciated than anything that had ever been there before. That I'm seeing the world through the eyes of my grandchildren, that I am learning about life in ways that are so simple and so shockingly easy to see, but I never saw. And I go, it took dying to Bruce to find the world, really. That Bruce saw a very limited spectrum, and now that spectrum has been changed.
Or a 2-month-old baby.
You what?
Or a 2-month-old baby.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I like that. So that's all I'm offering, you know, that awakening is to become new to the world, to become new to yourself every single day.
Well, this follows on that. I never heard you speak about it. I work with children, elementary school children, and I'm supposed to be in the helping role, but they often seem to be a lot less screwed up than I am. But having said that, is there something that we can do? Like, I work with two kids who have learning disabilities, where they're said to be ADHD, mm-hmm. and I have, do you have any insight into what their experience might be that makes them, for example, not listen very, very, very well, or have a need to constantly be moving or restless?
Sure.
If it's not something like that, is there something like that they're trying to keep out of their life, or something that?
I'm not a person who's very tutored in that, so I don't know that I have a good answer for you. I mean, George said sugar. You know, I think our culture has become a culture of profound distraction, and I think, you know, kids are watching television at a very, very early age. I look at my own grandson, who is allowed an hour of television a week, and I watch him watch that television, and every day afterwards, he wants television, television, television. And when he watches it, he is much more into it than he is into the world around him. And I see that because it's so hyper-real. It's hyper-active. And it pulls people into it, and therefore they want more and more and more of that. So I don't know, it's a theory, but I think too much screen time can actually harm kids and their ability.
Practice, like can you have the child breathe into his heart and hold his breath?
Yes. There are people teaching meditation to school children, and it's having profound effects. I've seen several movies on that.
My sense is that it would.
Oh, they actually think it's the craziest thing in the world, and then they love it. Because, like I say, you know, when you find this space inside you, it's like, oh my God, you know, look what's hiding in here. And it's peace, it's comfort, it's well-being, it's stillness, it's like relaxation without sleeping. It's so beautiful. And they find it, and they're thrilled by it. Anyone else? David?
Well, I'm the new guy, but I want to try to explain this question a little bit. Because, getting back to your talk, I've heard all of them, and probably all of Rudy's twice. This was a really great talk. And what I don't understand, my question has to do with living an unintentional life. Because every intention I've had from the mystical experience on has gotten me nowhere. There's an element of grace or luck or accident or something involved, which, you know, you just need to stay on the operating table for it, so on. So, for example, at the talk in 2010, were you meditating during the talk?
No. When the awakening took place?
Yeah.
No, I was trying to listen to Paul Hederman talk about awakening, and I couldn't follow a word he was saying. He was just talking with such velocity. The truths were so powerful. They kept rushing at me that my mind just said, I can't do this.
So that was an intention. Mm-hmm. The next thing you said in this talk was, if you meditate, you'll come to a deep place that will expand your
until awakening occurs, what can you do? What can you do to approximate that kind of awareness? What can you do that brings you close to it? And meditation. Well, you can do drugs. Here's the problem with drugs: is they're a glimpse into the world I talk about. Drugs are a mystical experience forced upon often unreceptive and unexpecting people. They don't know what happened, and because it's a drug, they immediately take it as a drug experience rather than a mystical experience. So I don't know that that's a good way to go, but there's been initiations in history, throughout history, of different groups that give people an awakening of some kind. You know, the Masonic Temple even. I mean, there's all these people who put you through a death and rebirth experience, whether it's real or whether it's just sort of metaphorical. That's what they're trying to do, to let you die to yourself and then get another name, ideally, or get another personality or another view of the world to free you from your limited scope. That's all. That's been there for.
You follow teachings, either this one or others, and you meditate, and you think, oh, one day I'll be meditating, and I'll samadhi will come.
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, it could, but it's not a given. It's not a given. Nothing's a given. You could be, you know. You know, I was talking to Hank before, he and then later his wife both had awakenings driving on the 28th, the road you used to come here. So it's very possible today on the way back you'll have an awakening on the 28th, especially now they have a detour. That may be something really special. I don't know. What's the rules here?
Everyone I've ever heard of has been different.
Has been what?
Different.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, you listen to all these awakenings and all these people talk about something else that's happened.
So what am I supposed to learn from that?
Well, probably that give up. Give up and just live your life. And that when you finally do that, you will realize that the life of the awakened, spiritual, enlightened person is not a lot different than yours.
Oh.
Really? Am I boring somebody?
Awesome.
Oh, that's okay. I am worried about boring you. This is.
No, I need some
animal. Oh, I'm not. Not me. Not personally. But. This is very frustrating. What do I do to get the thing I want, which is going to involve you disappearing? That you can't have it.
You can't want the thing you want.
Well, you can want it, but in the end...
That's the renderer's intention. Letting go is intention.
Yes, that's right.
Everything's intention.
That's right. And it's really at the core of the problem. You know, I'll surrender if I can disappear. I'll do this thing if I can get the thing that I want. You know, and yes, that, and it becomes a problem. And I'm telling you, when Rudy talks about surrender, and he said it's not surrender to get, it's not surrender of this or that or this, it's total, absolute, I surrender, I give up. And the AA people have this wonderful thing of, I'm helpless, go to a power greater than you. Ask for help. I buy that. Ask for help from a power greater than you. And, you know, see what happens. But the thing is, most people who do that want the result for them. And for spiritually guided people, the result will be very different than that. The result will be the elimination of the person asking for help. And that's shockingly powerful. Nobody can give it to you, but you can do the dance until it happens.
I think Richard Rose called it something like in-betweenness.
In-betweenness.
And then Ramana talked about surrender or self-inquiry.
People use all of these efforts.
Says just entertain the fact that you're not who you think you are.
Yes, yeah. It's all good. What else can you do? I mean, you do all of these different things, and then it either happens or doesn't. But trust me, it prepares you for an inevitability that will arrive, and you will be welcoming when it does, as opposed to, oh my God, I've been betrayed, or what happened, or I don't get it, or I'm psychotic. You know, none of that will take place for you. When it happens, you will go, aha. And it's always a little bit like, really? Because you know, it's not like what you think. It's even though you're prepared, it's not the thing you're expecting. It's just like, oh, wow, of course. That's what happens.
Isn't that why it doesn't no good to want it?
Kind of.
I don't know what I've
kind of
talked to.
Yeah, if you're wanting it is you're projecting a thing that you want,
yeah,
as opposed to giving up and accepting that this in its own ineffable way is it. Live accordingly. Live kindly, compassionately, do good work, if you will. Sit still, be available, enjoy the life you have. That's kind of what it comes down to. You know, and go deep. Or sit, stop, sit, stay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Couple things. Tomorrow, meeting at 11 o'clock here. There are no introductory classes. It's just for those of you who want to be here. If you have any questions, you know, this will be the time to ask them. Blanche and I hope to be back in August, potentially August 21st, like the last day of the Olympics. That's on our calendar. We're trying to make that happen. We'll be back again, hopefully, in October. And unless you guys finally decide that you've had enough. That's fine. I'm not worried about it. I'm fine with it. You can just go back and look at all the old talks. They kind of say it all. But anyway, we will be back. Here's the other thing, though, that's happened, just so you know. The effort to take over Big Indian as a not-for-profit has fallen apart. We didn't get the 501c3, and also we don't... We haven't raised the money, which is $300,000, in order to take this over. So it's not happening. So John Mann, who owns this, will continue to own it. But he will now, and starting today, charge for these weekends. And he's going to charge $500, you know, a weekend, which I think is reasonable. I have never, ever charged for the class, and I don't want to start charging now. But anyone who wants to, you know, donate to the cost of this, don't get guilty, guys, if you don't want to. It's not essential. But if you can, you know, $10, whatever, you know, we'll start to pay toward that $500, and we're happy to have it. But do not ever consider not coming to class because you don't have the cash to donate to this. But if you have it, great. We will be happy. Otherwise, Blanche and I will do it, and I know George has offered to participate. So we'll do it. But this is now operating a little differently than it did in the past, and so I'm throwing that out there. that's basically the news. And I will see you guys tomorrow morning, those of you who are here. And dinner now, do you all know in Phoenicia at Brio's restaurant? We go into the, what section?
Cantina.
The cantina, and the back room of the cantina. We'll all try to get there as soon as we can. First people, just put some long tables together, and we'll all sit and join each other and have a nice dinner.
How many people should we ask?
I think about 20 to 25. Okay.
Is this right now? Or?
Yeah, we'll go now. Yeah, if you're not hungry, just eat salad. Okay. Thank you.